Remember, you are not defined by your past. Just because you've made mistakes or could have made better decisions doesn't mean you're destined for the mistakes that you made in the past. The past is the past. You need to let it lie. You control your future. Some people get wrapped up in drugs, alcohol, crappy relationships in the past, but it doesn't mean, again, that it defines your future. My next guest is Tim Davis. He's known as Ultra Tim Davis. He's an avid ultra runner and triathlete and an advocate for mental health and 12-step programs. He has suffered from mental health issues for years, still suffers. But he teaches and coaches how physical training promotes mental, emotional, and spiritual healing. He is the author of Tripolar, the story of a bipolar triathlete. And his story is one of inspiration and how to overcome anything in your life. Do not miss this great interview with Ultra Tim Davis, next on the Criminal Justice Evolution podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Patrick here, host and creator of the top-ranked Criminal Justice Evolution podcast. Top-ranked because of you. I am so grateful for you for listening and sharing this show with everybody that you know. Thank you so much. It means the world to me. We have surpassed 400 episodes, and it's all because of you. Again, thank you so much. If you're not subscribed to the show, please do so. Share it with your family and friends like you've been doing. Thank you so much. And lastly, give us that 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Again, we sure would appreciate it. You know who else I'm grateful for? Are the brave men and women who protect us every day in the criminal justice field. Thank you so much for what you do. Very tough environment, but you put on the uniform, you put on the gun and the badge, and you do what you have to do every day. Again, thank you for your dedication and service. Remember this, you are honored, cherished, and above all, you are loved. Keep up the fantastic work. Folks, if you love coffee, and I know a lot of you do, you're in the criminal justice field, you're going to love the products and coffee from Four Sigmatic. I am a huge fan of this company, have been for many years, and I bet you will be too. My personal favorite is the Lion's Mane Mushroom Coffee. It gives me that energy, clarity, and zip that I need to get me through my often hectic days. If you head over to cjevolution.com, you're going to see a link to Four Sigmatic. And best of all, you're going to get 15% off of your purchases using the promo code CJEVO. Enjoy. Folks, I want to tell you about my good friends at Extra Duty Solutions. Extra Duty Solutions helps law enforcement agencies add efficiency and effectiveness to their extra duty programs while allowing them to focus on what really matters, and that's the safety of their citizens. They work with law enforcement agencies to administer their extra duty programs in the following areas: client interaction, scheduling, invoicing, collection, officer payments, feedback, problem resolution, cash flow management, and so much more. Their services are provided at no cost to the department and a minimal cost to the clients, and programs can be customized to meet the goals and unique needs of any agency. Folks, if you head over to extradutysolutions.com, that's extradutysolutions.com, let them help you run your extra duty program and tell them Patrick from the Criminal Justice Evolution podcast sent you. Folks, do you need help advertising or marketing with your product or service? Let Criminal Justice Evolution help you. We're top ranked. We got tens and thousands of downloads, and we can get you the exposure that you need to grow your business. Reach out to me at cjevolution.com. Send me an email and see how I can help grow your product or service. Enjoy this great interview with Tim Davis. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Very excited to have my next guest on the show. Tim Davis is a successful author. He's an avid runner and a triathlete and an advocate for mental health. And he's going to talk about his life and the great things he's doing now for everybody who is suffering from whatever they're suffering from with mental health. Tim, glad you're on the show, brother.
Hey, thanks for having me, Patrick. It's great to be here.
Well, I appreciate it, brother. You're the author of the super successful Tripolar, the story of a bipolar triathlete, which is yourself. And I want to talk about that in a little bit. But tell us how you got started on your journey, Tim. And without giving the whole book away, I mean, I know you suffered a lot as a kid. I mean, you had a lot of trauma and severe verbal and physical abuse in your youth. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I grew up in a household. I'm the third oldest of seven kids, a family of seven. My parents are, You know, my mom raised us Catholic. My mom had a Lester Maddox hickory stick. If you're from the South, you know what that is.
Oh, geez, yeah.
Okay, yeah. For the listeners that don't know it, it's kind of racist. It's really racist, actually. And my dad had his belt, you know, and, you know, me and my older brother, my older sister was, you know, daddy's girl. She was usually pretty good. My older brother was really rambunctious and really rebellious. And he was 4 years older than me. And so he got the firm hand a lot. And I went along with the shenanigans a lot because, you know, I looked up to my older brother. I was the third oldest. He was my older brother. He's cool. And, you know, if he's saying, let's go climb on a train, I'm right there with him, you know, pretty yeah. much. You know? So I got some whoopings too, because I followed suit. You know, my dad was my protector though. You know, when my older brother whooped on me too much, my dad whooped on him. Mm. And so like things got bad when my dad died when I was 13. There was that whole traumatic event. And then my older brother blamed me for his death. And then I lost my protector and I thought it was my fault that my dad died. So I just had a lot of stuff going on at age 13 and I'd already experimented with drugs and alcohol thanks to the leadership of my older brother. And that's when I really started, you know, seeking to use drugs and alcohol to kind of escape, you know, pain and negative feelings that I didn't know how to process. And my mom never sought any kind of real therapy for us. I mean, back then in the 80s, I don't think therapy was looked upon as favorably as it is now. We're really slow to really, I think we're doing way better now in this century with mental health. But that's kind of my big thing is to push for, advocate for mental health because, you know, the help I've got from, you know, my therapist and my psychiatrist and 12 steps has been amazing. I would not be who I am today without all of that work and that help that I got.
Mm-hmm. But it has to be intrinsic too, right, brother? I mean, you have to want to get help. I mean, that's part of the basis with therapy, right? I mean, you have to be willing to, you know, realize you hit rock bottom and ask for help. I mean, you people helped you, but you did a lot of the work, right?
Yeah. You have to be willing to ask for help. I mean, that's what they say. I still go to AA and other 12 step groups. And if you aren't surrendered, as we say you have to surrender to win. Cause once you surrender and like, hey, I got this disease, I need help, you know, and you really believe you got this disease that's trying to kill you, then you can really get help and be ready to take direction and follow other people's, you know, steps instead of your own, you know, your own path, you know, because for us, it's like insanity. We keep doing the same thing over and over and getting the same negative results, you know.
Yeah. Now, what, if you don't mind me asking, I mean, how did your brother, I mean, what was he saying to you about your dad passing away? I mean, how was he blaming you for this?
Well, when the accident happened, you know, my brother wasn't even at home. He was at his job at McDonald's. He was 16 or maybe 17. And I was, you know, me and my sister were having tickle wars with my dad. We were just playing, having fun, you know, and my dad had been, it was a Saturday. He'd been drinking. He usually put down a 12 pack on a Saturday and a Sunday, you know, and he drank a lot when he wasn't working. And, you know, we have this big house and we were having these tickle wars and, you know, and then we were playing chase and I was getting away from him, like, you know, just running away saying, ha ha, you can't catch me. And I ran down the hallway and out onto our balcony and then all the way down the balcony to the other end and back in through the other entrance back into the house. And my dad, you know, he's like 5'9", kind of probably about 250, kind of rotund guy with a big old beer gut, you know, wasn't very active guy. You know, he was a lawyer, had a sedentary job. He didn't quite make that right turn back into the master bedroom. He tripped and, you know, fell over the balcony and landed head first on our driveway below, you know, onto the asphalt. So yeah, that was bad. He broke his first four cervical vertebra and, he was basically brain dead on impact, but he was in a coma for 8 months before he expired. My brother's issue was, that him and my dad had my older brother was always so rebellious and he was just at odds with my dad, you know, through his early teenage years. And just, I think it was, he was a senior in high school and he was just starting to mend past that and start to kind of have a good relationship with my dad. You know, they're kind of, I guess, having an understanding with him, or he was getting mature enough where they could, you know, talk to each other like men and without all the, you know, arguing and fighting. And so that was one of the things he was saying to me that night is like, you know, me and dad were just starting to get along and now you took him away from me. It's your fault he's dead. You know, you effing killed him. You know, how could you do this to me? And that was never part of my plan. But at age 13, I thought, that was my fault.
Yeah. I mean, at 13, where you you know, are very impressionable, and you, you know, most kids at that age are going to take things to heart, and it caused you to lose your faith, right? I mean, you mentioned you're Catholic. I mean, I grew up Catholic too, and and you questioned God, and then you went down, you know, the dark path that you describe. And what was the catalyst, brother? I mean, what was the thing that, you know, I know you had near fatal years, right? Your 20s.
Yeah. My 20s were, especially my later 20s, were really, had a few near death experiences.
But what was the
drug and alcohol related?
Was that the turning point? Because I saw in my job in law enforcement where, you know, I worked in a small area, and it seemed like we were going to calls with the same people all the time, and they were just kind of, you know, we'd bring them back with Narcan and things like that, and you know, they kept falling into that. You know what I mean? And it wasn't, they kept going down that path, and they didn't have like an aha moment and I know it's addiction. I know it's powerful.
Yeah.
But what was your aha moment where you said, shit, I gotta figure stuff out. I gotta do something different.
Yeah. I had a couple moments of clarity or aha moments, in my mid to late 20s. First time was when I was 27. And at that time I was doing methamphetamine. And I had been up for a week on speed, and I was tired of being awake because I was starting to hear voices. I was paranoid, and I was partying with my two younger brothers, especially my youngest brother. He was 16 at the time, and I took a bunch of downers because I wanted to come down, but they weren't kicking in. So my, you know, meth infected brain said, let's just go get more meth then, you know. And by the time we started driving, about halfway through the drive, those downers did kick in, and I smashed into the back of a parked car because I fell asleep, and I passed out at the wheel. And my little brother was in the front seat, and he didn't have a seatbelt on, and he was pretty drunk and high too. And his head went through the windshield. He broke his nose and got a black eye. He was okay, but that was my first aha moment, because I ended up checking in rehab, you know, that night. It was just like, whoa, that was the first time I realized, you know, my drinking and using could hurt somebody else. Up until that point, I always thought I was never hurting anybody else except for maybe myself.
Just yourself,
but I wasn't hurting anybody else. So why do you guys care how much I drink and use? I'm not hurting you. I'm not, you know, this is me. This is who I am, you know, kind of all that stuff. And then the other moment was a couple years later, when I had burned through a couple more jobs and a couple more relapses. And my sponsor at the time had been sponsoring me for a while. He had a real close friend who had 15 years sober, and the guy went out on alcohol, maybe pain meds, I can't remember. But a week later, he was found dead in his car. He overdosed on heroin. And he took me to his funeral, and he just said, you know, that could be you in there. That could be me in there. It could be any one of us. You know, alcoholism, addiction are deadly diseases. You know, it doesn't care whether you're white, black, Asian, brown, rich, poor, fat, skinny, smart, dumb, it will take you out. It's a equal opportunity ass kicker, he said. And then he took me back to my rehab, and, you know, we sat down before this meeting, and it was like, we were having some food, and he goes, walk around this room and look at all the other guys in here. He's like, you know what all these other guys in here in this treatment center are? It's like, you guys are all just a bunch of dead men walking. And then he went on to say, he's like, you know what? You could die from this disease today, tomorrow. And he's like, your wife and your kids will be sad. I had two young boys at the time. She's like, but eventually your wife will find a new man, you know, and he'll be the father to your children. And when he said that to me, that was when I was like, that's when I just prayed to God and I started having faith again. And I'm like, I don't want anybody to replace me. I mean, I don't want the same thing to happen to my kids that happened to me.
Yeah.
You know, to lose their father at a young age. So that was when I was like really grabbed onto the program and made it a commitment to work all 12 steps. I also made a secret deal with myself that if I worked all 12 steps and still felt like drinking, I was going to drink. But first I had to get through all 12 steps thoroughly.
Wow. That's yeah.
I got through all 12 steps. And by the time I was about halfway through, the obsession was lifted, as they say it does, especially after the fourth and fifth step, I really felt free. Where you, do your inventory and then you share it with your sponsor.
Now, how long have you been sober now, brother?
I have been sober for 13 and a half years.
Wow. Congratulations, man.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Congratulations. So again, your story is so amazing because, okay, you're getting treatment. You've done the 12 steps. How did you go from, okay, a guy who is trying to get through his addictions, working through his addictions, to shit, I'm a triathlete now, and I'm kicking ass. I'm a 12-time Ironman finisher, one-time double Ironman finisher. All these accolades to your name. Were you always an athlete or what?
You know, as a kid, I was, you know, I was always hyper and anxious, and I was riding my bike everywhere and very active. And I played sports, a lot of sports in high school. I played football, basketball. I wrestled 1 year and I ran track all 4 years. I
Wow.
always did like running, and I was kind of the smart ass in football practice that made the stupid joke, and the coach said, take another lap. And I never gave a shit because I love
You're
running.
like, screw it, I'll run.
I'm like, this is not punishment because I like to run. I was kind of like Forrest Gump out there, you know. So, and then in college, I got into marathon running, and I kind of got into marathon running as a way of trying to control, you know, how much I was drinking and smoking weed, because I would focus on the training and I would cut back on how much I drank and smoked weed. And that's what it says in the big book. It says, you know, for people trying to get sober, a lot of them, one of the things they do is they take up bouts of rigorous physical exercise to try and, you know, control how much, you know, or slow down at least their moderate their drinking and using. And so that's when I got into marathon running, was in college. I ran the LA Marathon every year in college. And then I had kids right after, a couple of years after college, and kind of got away from it. When my boys were little, I started putting on weight. I gained 15 pounds with each of my wife's pregnancy. And I was also digging deeper and deeper into my disease. When I finally got sober, I was actually 180 pounds when I first got sober, but that's because I was doing a lot of meth. I am 5'9". And then in my first year of sober, I gained 60 pounds. And because, you know, my sponsor and everybody, my therapist, they're like, don't worry about what you eat. You know, just make sure you go to, you know, 2 to 3 meetings every day and stay sober, stay off the drugs and alcohol. So I
Yeah, you
was
can
chain
lose
smoking
all
a pack
that.
of cigarettes. Yeah. I was chain smoking this pack of cigarettes a day, and I was eating all the cakes and cookies at the meetings. And I was finishing my boys' plates at dinner, and, you know, every meal that, you know, there's, you know, it's just, and it was finally, it was December 31st, 2008. I stepped on the scale and it said, I weighed 250. And I was just like, that was my aha moment there. I was like, whoa, you know, that rounds up to 300. And I didn't like that. I'm like, at this, in my mind, I'm like, at this rate, I'm going to end up on the show, The Biggest Loser. And I didn't want to gain that much more weight, really get obese to even qualify to be on the show. So I made a New Year's resolution to stop eating seconds, to start exercising every day. And I wouldn't allow myself to watch TV or play video games unless I exercise for at least an hour that day. And those were the three things I started doing on January 1st, 2009. I lost 60 pounds in 6 months, and I was started running back slowly. I mean, I remember January 1st, 2009. I went out to run a mile because that was my event in high school. I used to run a sub 5 minute mile in high school. That was my main event. And then I went out and ran this mile, and I had to walk a lot, and it took me like 12 minutes. And I was mad and angry and depressed, but I'm like, all right, that's the starting point, you know. A 12 minute mile is what I can do right now. And my goal was to get back down to a 5 minute mile. I did get back down to a 5:15, and I didn't crack five again, but you know, but I got back, you
Jeez.
know, much closer to what I was in high school, which was pretty good considering I was in my mid 30s at that time. And then I had this weird hip injury. Because I lost the 60 pounds so fast, I really actually lost most of it in 4 months. My kind of hip went out of alignment. And basically, I saw a few specialists, and my doctor basically said, your body's just out of whack because you lost so much weight so fast. It's kind of recalibrating itself. So this hip injury actually prevented me from running for almost 3 months. But in the meantime, I wanted to keep losing weight and staying fit. So I started cross training, and that's when I started swimming and biking and really getting hooked on that. So when I could run again, I'm like, well, hell, I may as well try a triathlon. And I did a triathlon, and I just loved it. Even though when I went to my first triathlon, I was in an old mountain bike with rusty tires, and I had these big old baggy Lakers basketball shorts and like this cracked mountain biking helmet. And these other guys are in there with like these, you know, gymnastic looking tri suits and these arrow
Sponsors and
I'm like, look at who are these? Those must be the pros. And no, a lot of the amateurs dress in all the pro gear. And I just, you know, I ended up getting 16th place in my age division and finishing like in the top 50. And there was like 500 people in the race. I'm like, wow, you know, if I really, really focus on this, I could do well. And I ended up, you know, getting all the gear and the carbon fiber bike. I got a Cervelo P2 and just got hooked on it and started doing, you know, I live in Southern California. The weather's really nice here. So they have
You
them
can do it all year.
almost all year round. Yeah. So I just started doing a ton of them and she really got hooked on it. And, you know, it's kind of off and running, well, off and swimming and biking and running for since 2009.
Wow. Now, what do you concentrate on when you're, 'cause I know you've done 7 times, you're a 7-time 100-mile endurance run finisher. Amazing. And so what, I got to ask maybe it's probably a stupid question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What the hell are you thinking about when you're doing 100-mile run? Do you do it in parts? Forgive my ignorance. Do you do it in parts, or do you just do
Oh,
it
yeah.
straight?
Oh, no. I love the question because I get asked that a lot. Sometimes people say, I don't even want to drive 100 miles, let alone, run 100 miles. But most of the 100 miles I've run are the mountain trail 100 mile runs. And they usually have what they call aid stations where you can get more food and water or Gatorade or
You know, that makes
whatever.
sense. Keep you going.
They have those every 5 to 8 miles, most of them, So you carry a little pack or maybe a couple of handheld water bottles, but then you get to these stations and you get some more fuel because you need to be burning about, you're burning a lot of calories and you need to replace at least 200 to 300 calories per hour, depending on your body size. Me, I'm still 185, so it's usually 200 or 300 calories per hour. And I've seen my 100, the flat 100 mile runs I've done, I've been able to do in about 22 hours, which is good, but compared to the pro guys, it's not very fast. Like these elite
Jesus.
guys are doing the 100 mile runs in like 12, 14 hours on flat courses. And even on the mountain courses, like my mountain ones have taken me from anywhere from 28 to 32 hours. And these guys are doing it, in under 24 hours, getting the silver buckles, as they say. But what you think about a lot of times, honestly, you just think about getting to the next aid station.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense when and the more I think about it, because you don't want to think about, oh shit, I'm at mile 80. You just want to kind of do it in increments, right?
Yeah, I know. If you get to mile 20 and think, huh, only 80 miles to go, that's kind of discouraging. I have
Yeah.
jokingly said that before too. I'm like, hey, we've got 20 miles down, only 80 to go. And everybody's like, shut up.
Shut up, dude. Just get to the next aid station.
Yeah. One
Let's
aid
get
station at a time. Just like
Now.
the 12-step program, one day at a time, 100 mile race is just one aid station, or one, sometimes it's 1 mile at a time, or even one step at a time. It just depends. It's, running an ultra marathon is like a metaphor for life because there are times when you feel really high and elevated and you're feeling good and you love it. And then, you get sore, your electrolytes out of whack. And there's times where you feel like, man, I'm never going to make it. You go to these dark places in your head. And it's like you have these highs and lows over the 100 miles. I mean, so I've had 100 mile races where the last 5 miles were my fastest 5 miles because I'm
Wow.
so close to the finish line, I can taste it. So I'm just speeding up and I'm just, I'm on cloud nine or that runner's high, But I've had other ones where I like just walked to the finish line and like kind of fell over. It just really
Yeah.
depends on how your body feels and, if it, how mad it is at you that day or not mad at you.
Well, and I mean, you really have to know a lot of shit about your nutrition and what your, listen to your body and all that stuff, right?
It's kind of a trial and error thing too, because different things work for different people. I know for me, in my first 400 mile runs, I, having taken advice from veterans, I could eat solid food for the first 50 miles, but after something happened to my body about halfway through the race, after 50 miles, I couldn't even chew on solid food. So I would take like CarboPro or Tailwind, some of that stuff where it's, they put the calorie mix into the water. So it's just a fluid drink, but it's got calories in it. And those gels and goo packets. I would take some of those, but a lot of those have too much citric acid and that'll upset your stomach. So it's like kind of a whole, there was some trial and error that I figured out through my first five or so, but now I've got my stomach's like an iron stomach. I can eat solids the whole way through now. It's like it's used to it. It's like I know what you're doing, and I can eat anything and everything now. It's just not a problem. I'm like the wonder disposal out there at all these aid stations.
And I like what you say, Tim, about how you talk about physical training promotes the mental, emotional, and spiritual healing. Do you think, just an opinion, do you think if more people that were suffering from whatever mental health problem they're suffering with, do you think that if they did more physical training, they would feel better and emotionally and mentally and spiritually?
Absolutely, 100%. I think that's that, from writing this book, that's my biggest message is that even if you go to my website, that's like the first thing it says is like, it's in order to maintain good mental health, you have to do regular exercise. And it was the one thing that doctors and, people in the 12-step program recommended was like, just, because I, when I wasn't exercising, like, just go for a walk, just do something, to lift your moods up, and I was stuck in my depression and not listening to them, being stubborn. And it wasn't until I hit 250 pounds where I was like, okay, I got to do something, But man, it just the way it gets the different hormones going, it raises your serotonin levels, your oxytocin levels, you hear about the runner's high, you get those endorphin levels high up, and you just feel better. It's like, I mean, I think I'm not a psychiatrist, and I don't want to. I'm not going to go off my meds. I say I take what my doctor prescribes me now after learning the hard way so many times. But I think there's a lot of people that might have mental health issues that if they just had a regular exercise program, they might not even need medications. But I don't want to prescribe that for anybody
Yeah.
because again,
Everybody's different.
a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
But I think there are, and I know some people that kind of seem like they might be a little mentally, you know, ill in some ways, but they have a regular exercise program, so they're mostly stable.
Yeah.
So yeah, I definitely think it's very important. Absolutely.
So I love the title of your book, Tripolar: Story of a Bipolar Triathlete. When did you write the book? And I mean, what made you write? I mean, you wanted to give back, right, to people who are suffering.
Yeah, my ultimate goal was to inspire and help other people struggling with mental health issues, maybe not bipolar, but maybe depression or anxiety, mm-hmm. or whatever. Because people with bipolar disorder have depression and anxiety too. They're two of the symptoms that we suffer from with our bipolar, mm-hmm. and or any other mental health issue, or people who are struggling with trying to get sober, because that's a big part of my story. You know, I was self-medicating with drugs and alcohol for years. And for people who are trying to lose weight, I'm like, I'll write this book. And, you know, maybe some people have one of the problems. Maybe somebody has all the problems. You know, just let them know there is a way, maybe not my way, but
yeah, yeah.
Just to try and inspire people, to let them know that not everybody dies from alcoholism and addiction. You know, not everybody that has mental illness has to suffer from it their whole life. There is recovery, you know.
You got to surround yourself with the right people too, right? I mean,
yeah. Yeah, when I got sober, I just stopped, you know, when I really finally got sober, I had to stop hanging around with my little brothers for 3 years. And I just dropped all my old friends, all my old college friends. We're all, you know, most of my college friends, we partied way too hard together. So
I
barely talked to any of them anymore. I see a couple of them on social media and they seem to be doing better now too.
Now, what about your brothers? Are they still in that, you know, partying all the time, or have they gotten sober or what?
Well, my youngest brother died from alcoholism at age 32 2 years ago. Yeah. So alcoholism got him 2 years ago, and he kind of just never really had any period. He had a 9-month period of sobriety, I think, when he was 13 or 16.
Wow.
And that's when he got in trouble at school, and he was actually on probation and had to go to meetings. And we went to meetings together for a while. My other brother's, my next youngest brother, he's kind of ADHD, so he kind of self-medicates with marijuana, and he's one of those guys that talks so fast, you know, that it's kind of good he takes the marijuana, because it actually slows him down to talking at a normal rate, so, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
And my other brother, I know he does, you know, marijuana to help himself get to sleep,
yeah.
He doesn't really party a lot, you know. He might drink every once in a while, but he seems pretty normal because he works out all the time, and he pays his bills, he works his jobs, he's a functional guy for sure.
Yeah.
And then my oldest brother is kind of estranged from the whole family, and I know he uses marijuana daily, and we're all happy that he does that too, because he's got huge anger issues, and when he doesn't have his marijuana, he's just
mellows,
like,
Mr.
Road Rage times 10. So so we're kind of glad that he, even with the marijuana, and he still has a lot of anger issues. So I don't know. I haven't spoken to him in 10 years. He doesn't speak to most people in the family. So he's kind of,
sorry to hear that. Now Tim, what's next for you, brother? I mean, you've done all this stuff. You're a successful author. I forgot to mention you teach, right? You're a high school teacher.
Yeah.
You know, you got a BS in exercise science, master's in education. So you're doing that. I mean, you're kicking ass in the fitness arena with all your, you know, triathletes and stuff, or triathlons and stuff. What's next? I mean, you've accomplished what most can't.
I know.
Or won't.
I know. I'm just in sobriety. And I think I've always kind of just been goal oriented. Every time I finish a race, I'm thinking about the next race. Right now with the pandemic, it's kind of, you know, put a lot of races on hold. They've been rolled over to the next year, and some of them are postponed indefinitely. But I am signed up for the Tahoe 200 mile race in September.
Just 200 miles, Tim?
Yeah.
Just 200 miles.
It has a 100-hour time limit, though. So that's like, I got 4 days. I just have to average 50 miles a day.
I was happy when I did my first Tough Mudder. I was like, God damn it, I finished it. That's awesome. And then you're talking about 200 miles.
Well, I'm talking about it. I haven't done it yet. I have friends.
I have a feeling you're going to do it with ease, probably.
Well, I don't know about with ease, but I mean, unless my body shuts down, the plan is to keep moving one foot in front of the other until I get to that finish line.
That's awesome, brother. Where can people reach out to you, brother? You mentioned your website. Where can they find that? Where can they find your book?
All right. Yeah. The website's www.ultratimdavis.com. And you can, you know, there's a button where you can get to my email through there. My social media links are on there. The book you can find, there's links to my book on the website. It's available through Amazon, Apple Books, Barnes & Noble, Indie Books, and a few other book depository. It's available in paperback, ebook and Kindle, and also audiobook. And if you don't want to go to my website, if you just search Tripolar Tim Davis and Google, it should be the first thing that pops up on Amazon. So, and I think Apple Books too. So.
Tim, thank you so much, buddy, for being here. You're an inspiration. God bless you. I'm glad you were able to turn things around and just kicking ass and taking names along the way. Much success to you in the future, thanks. My friend.
I hope your listeners, you know, this was helpful for them and how they, you know, have to deal with the people they deal with that might also have mental health issues.
You know? Yeah. I mean, first, I was telling you, you know, first responders deal with a lot of people with mental issues. I think we're better trained now, Tim, than we were back in the day when I started in law enforcement over, you know, 2 decades ago. But it's always great to have somebody like you on the show that it gives people hope. It gives people inspiration that, yeah, I might be suffering, but look at this guy. He's doing it.
You know, when I first started accepting having bipolar disorder, I kind of Googled, you know, famous people with bipolar disorder, and there's a lot of familiar names on that list, you know, like a lot of former presidents and great actors and politicians. And I can't remember any of them right now, but there's a lot of names you'd recognize. I'm like, these guys all had it too. I'm like,
I mean, nobody ever, you never know what people are suffering with, right? Yeah.
But that inspired me. I'm like, well, if those guys could lead, you know, these amazing lives, then, you know, I can do it too. So it's just good to know there are people out there that not just, you know, off on themselves or whatever, or just wallowing in depression their whole life, and that are still getting out there doing productive things and giving back to society. So
yeah, look at Ultra Tim Davis, brother.
I'm trying.
Honor having you on the show, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, Patrick. This was great.
All right, brother. Take care.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.